relief column marched into Peking in July, Tzu Shi fled in disgrace, taking with her the last chance of imperial resurgence. In the conflict between unreasoning Chinese pride and relentless foreign commercial and philosophical expansionism that had raged for 60 years, there seemed to be no middle ground, and now Chinese pride had lost the long battle. Yet there had once been such a middle ground in the Middle Kingdom, or at least the possibility of it. For the briefest moments during the 1860s, the imperial government in Peking, as well as the foreign powers, had gotten a glimpse of a China in which progressive Western ideas, particularly military ideas, would be placed at the service of the emperor and his ministers to ensure the empire's survival and participation in a rapidly changing world. Unfortunately, both the Chinese imperialists and the Westerners, as if horrified by their glimpse of this strange future, had slammed the door on it. But not before the names of those who had so briefly cracked the portal open had been recorded and honored by the Chinese people. Legends quickly grew around those names, as at least one group of American soldiers discovered during their occupation of Peking in the summer of 1900. Writing a quarter of a century later, one of these men recalled, "There was much talk among the soldiers as to who had been the first to enter the Forbidden City, where no white devil was ever supposed to have been before. One day a group of us were arguing about the matter before a little Chinese shop, where we had stopped for one thing or another, and of a sudden the old merchant spoke up in pidgin English. What did it matter, he wanted to know, which one of us had by force of arms broken into the temples of the gods? We were disrespectful of the gods, we were like burglars for all our bravery, and we could never be the first white men to enter a sacred Chinese temple anyway, because there was Hua, the white god. Hua had been braver than any of us, and he had been good, too. He had come from far across the sea to fight for China, and he had been carried into a sacred temple and was there still. His was a victory of right." The Hua of whom the old Chinese merchant spoke was Frederick Townsend Ward, a young soldier of fortune from Salem, Massachusetts, who had come to China in 1859 and offered his services to the imperial government in its bitter war against a hugely powerful group of quasi-Christian mystics calling themselves the Taipings. When he arrived in Shanghai, Ward was 28 years old and penniless. When he died in battle 3 years later, he was the most honored American in Chinese history, a naturalized Chinese subject, and a Mandarin entitled to wear the prestigious peacock feather in his cap. He had married the daughter of another Mandarin and received high praise from the emperor. But above all, he had assembled out of the most improbable elements an army that was unlike anything China or the world had ever seen. A highly disciplined force of native Chinese soldiers, commanded by Western officers, that was expert in the use of modern foreign weapons and capable of defeating vastly superior numbers of opponents in the field. Known to the Taiping rebels as Devil Soldiers, Ward's men were dubbed the Zhang Sheng Jun, the ever-victorious army by Peking. And after Ward died, a memorial temple and Confucian shrine were built around his grave. More than any other person or organization, Ward and his ever-victorious army had pointed the way toward a different kind of China, one in which Manchu chauvinism would have given way to reasoned Chinese acceptance of outside assistance. That assistance would in turn have allowed the empire to avoid a violent collision with progress and emerge as a 20th century power. China's failure to follow such a course had, certainly, less to do with Ward's untimely death than with the fact that the Manchus did not truly desire progress and the West did not desire China to be a power. But the momentary achievement itself, the transitory